Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 125 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Note that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know your listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. At present, you can donate via PayPal using david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.html for more information. If you'd like me to speak at an organization you are a member of, on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or other social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. And now to our guest for this week. Bruce Alexander is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Psychology at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, near Vancouver, Canada. He joined Simon Fraser, or as we call it in Canada, SFU, in 1970, and before that worked at the Oregon Regional Primate Research Center, Oregon Medical School, and Miami University. He was a founding member of the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy and has also worked with the Drug Policy Foundation in the U.S., the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and others. He recently published the book, The Globalization of Addiction, A Study in Poverty of the Spirit. Previous books are A History of Psychology and Peaceful Measures, Canada's Way Out of the War on Drugs. His websites are brucekalexander.com and, relevant to this discussion, globalizationofaddiction.ca. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thank you, David.
I hope I got your long career in a little bit of a nutshell there.
Well, you did admirably. I would mention one thing, however.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My recent book is actually, my most recent book is not The Globalization of Addiction, but the one which you mentioned briefly called A History of Psychology in Western Perspective. And I mentioned that because I think in when we talk about addiction, I will revert to history over and over and over again. I think there's so much to be learned by looking at it historically. Mm-hmm. So in a way, that's where my interests are going, although they begin with, you know, in the laboratory, as you know.
Well, how did you get interested in addiction?
Well, I went to Vancouver in 1970, and I was there. They have this wonderful custom in academic departments, which is that the youngest guy has to teach the course that nobody else wants to teach.
Yeah, I think I've heard of that rule.
So they had a course called Social Issues, which amounted to a course on heroin addiction. So I had to teach it. Well, I didn't know anything. So I went downtown and I interviewed through one of the local social service agencies. I interviewed quite a number of heroin addicts and was fascinated by the fact that they were telling me a different story than what I had read in my textbooks and what I was teaching from my textbooks. So I thought, wow, this story is a whole different story. And it went on from there. I had to do some laboratory research to kind of test if their different story made sense
right.
or not.
Right. And for context for the listeners, most of the listeners are probably in the U.S. or other countries. You know, people might have a really rosy picture of Canada, but Vancouver, particularly what they call the East End, the downtown area near the harbor, has a huge drug problem.
Vancouver is Canada's drug addiction capital, and in those days it was also its war on drugs capital. We
right.
had two big prisons within the city, which were mainly filled with people that were picked up in the downtown east side and beaten up and put in prison.
Well, Yeah, well, I want to get to the two sort of normal ways to approach addiction, the medicalization and the criminalization. But let's first put this in context with a previous show I did with a neuroscientist, Mark Lewis, whose book was titled Addiction is Not a Disease. And we don't want to cover all the same ground, but would you agree with that proposition in his title, that addiction is not a disease?
Yeah, addiction is not a disease. There's a very well-funded industry which tries to create the impression that addiction is a disease and we are just waiting for the doctors to invent the right drug to cure it. Well, you can kiss that one goodbye. Lots and lots of very, very good scientists and scholars are just saying, kiss that goodbye. That's just silly.
And let's talk about criminalization. Like, I don't know if there's anybody who really seriously believes that the war on drugs hasn't been a massive failure, but it still generates huge revenue for the prison industrial complex. A lot of the time, border guards are spending looking for drugs and that kind of thing. I mean, if you took away the money, do you think the war on drugs would last 5 minutes?
Yes and no. Of course, the people who are thinking about it all see that it's a massive failure, as you say. On the other hand, we have the president of the Philippines who has executed thousands and thousands of people since his election.
Right.
And he does because he believes in the war on drugs. And if you read between the lines in some of the stuff which is being written now, in what we are calling the fentanyl crisis,
right?
You will see little voices saying, "Oh, if only we could get really tough with these guys, we'd take care of that stuff." And that's scary. Yes, the war on drugs has been definitely discredited by anyone who's thinking carefully and on a large scale. But people get panicky, and then they think once again, "Oh, well, if you know, we just gotta lock those guys up for life or whatever
right.
it is." So it's not, it's, I think of it as a zombie. It's dead, but it's still walking around.
Well, given the amount of focus that Western civilizations have put on punishment for just about every crime they can think of, including drug and alcohol crimes, you would think that by now they would have eliminated crimes because they've thrown so many millions of people in jail. But it seems like crime is just as big of a problem. And it's like criminalization, even for things like assault and robbery doesn't really seem to resolve the underlying problems. One thing I wanted
That's right, and I think we ought to think about that as an experiment. Like, we've done this huge experiment with drugs and other things, this huge experiment in saying, can we solve this with police measures? The results of the experiment are clear. No, we can't make a dent in it with police measures. So good, let's talk about Plan B.
Well, one of the approaches to addiction that's pretty low tech and seems to have helped a lot of people is the sort of the AA approach, which has been extended from alcohol to drugs to gambling to sex to other things. I mean, what do you think about that as an approach to helping people who are addicted to a substance?
It's a very good approach, and it was very good when it was invented, I think, essentially by St. Augustine in the 4th century AD, because it goes way, way back in Christian history. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It's a method which helps a lot of people. Unfortunately, it doesn't help most people because we're no longer in the early Christian era where, you know, people could accept certain kinds of doctrines, you know, without questioning very much. We have a more complex world now. But AA and BA and CA and DA, you can go through the whole alphabet.
Right.
Well, really, you can. I've tried it. And, you know, all of these Alcoholics Anonymous-based organizations do help some people. They save lives. There's nothing wrong with them, except that they're not going to solve the problem. They do make a dent in it.
Right. Now, you said in the title of your book, The Globalization of Addiction, the subtitle is A Study in Poverty of the Spirit. So how is that not like blaming the victim? Like it's not, you don't have a disease, you're not a criminal, this is your fault. I mean, what are you saying about people through that? Like, what do you think is the cause of addiction?
I guess I'm saying that poverty of the spirit is the malaise of our time. It's the malaise of modernity. I suffer from poverty of the spirit. Many, many, many people who I interview and who I know personally suffer from poverty of the spirit, and they don't mind saying so. And many of them, including myself, have had addictive junctures in our life, and most of them got over it because they realized that didn't work, so let's move on. But some of them didn't get over it, and I of course know people who have died. So poverty of the spirit is not meant to say, it's not meant to say that there are certain people who have poverty of the spirit. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," as if that was someone else. But right. Really, what I mean to say is that the poor in spirit is most of us in these times, because we live in terrible times. And that, I think, is the single fact which is left out of almost every discussion on addiction, is that we do not live in normal times. Anyone who followed the American election knows this. We live in terrible times, and a time in which poverty of the spirit is a big problem.
Okay, let's talk about, you seem to be saying with some of the things you've written that it's not really drugs that are addictive, it's people. Is that fair? Like, do you believe that, if I was to take heroin today or cocaine for the first time, would I have a risk of becoming addicted? And is it the drug that's doing that, or is it me that's doing that?
Well, I'd have to know you a little better. But I can tell you about me. I took heroin for the first time, and I took cocaine for the first time, and I didn't have any issue with it whatsoever. So that is most people's experience. I'm just typical.
Did you feel like after you'd taken it once that you really wanted to do that again?
Oh, no. Oh, come on. I guess that you haven't taken it, or you wouldn't say that, I think.
No, I haven't.
No. And I have to confess, I did not inject heroin. I took what was in those days called hillbilly heroin. It was OxyContin. Right. And this is the one that everyone's freaking out about now, that and fentanyl. For most people, those things are not an issue. So to go back to the issue of poverty of the spirit, there's a lot of people who, as I said, I'm one of them, who in much of our life have suffered from, anxiety and rootlessness and dislocation and absence of meaning and purpose and so forth. That's what I mean by poverty of the spirit. And many people who are suffering in that way find something they can glom onto. Now, for most, that somehow relieves it. And for most people, that something is not drugs. For example, it's much more likely to be hypersexuality and sex addiction, or gambling addiction, or internet addiction, and all those things. People get hooked on those things just as much as they get hooked on drugs.
Well, do you think the majority of people are hooked on something, or do you think that maybe half the people dabble in the internet, dabble in alcohol, maybe dabble in drugs, other things, but never really get to the point of what we might call addicted?
I think that here's my guess, and it's based on some statistics, but it's still a guess. I guess that more than half the people have been addicted at some point to something, mm-hmm. and know what that is and know not to do that anymore, but they got over it. Now, some of that large number of people, of course, remain addicted until it kills them. And those are the ones that make the headlines, and that's what we're reading about, the fentanyl crisis and all that. But the larger number of people I believe the majority of people have experienced addiction at some point or another and know they have to deal with it in order to stay away with it, away from it. The reason I know that is from just doing large-scale interview studies and reading other people's large-scale interview studies. What you do that when you interview large numbers of people is you don't find a lot of people who are addicted right now, but you find a lot of people who were, and they can talk about it eloquently.
And you actually make the point that the most common way to become unaddicted, to kick the habit, is to do it by yourself.
Well, by yourself with a little help from your friends.
Right.
Now, it's never by yourself. I suppose if you were all by yourself, you wouldn't have much hope. But if your husband or wife is going to help you, or if your children are going to encourage you, or if your good friends are going to say, "Hey, come on, let's go do something else now," or if you're going to get involved in something, some worthy project, or if you're going to become religious and get involved in the church, or if you're going to get involved in politics or whatever it is. It's what people, most people who become addicted, this is a fact, this is not a guess. Most people who become addicted get over it, and they get over it by changing their life in a way which is visibly social, like they do
right.
Something with other people.
One of the things I got from Mark Lewis's book, which talked a huge amount about neurochemistry and things like that, I thought it was interesting, but I thought that the neurochemistry was secondary to the addiction. In other words, the addiction caused your brain to change, so you're not really getting closer to the root cause. But what I saw in his book, which was full of sort of anecdotal stories, people's stories who had been addicts, at the root seemed to be hopelessness and loneliness.
Yeah, and I heard that. You sent me the interview, and I read it. I heard it. I heard you say that. Yeah, and he didn't pick up on it quite as much with emphasis as you said it. Now, if I could say about Mark Lewis, like he's a leader in our field. This is a good guy, and I know him, and he's a friend. My criticism of him is that he reverts to all this brain language, and as do many other psychologists these days. Like, brain language is the jargon of today's psychology, and I wish people would just stop it. Most of us who talk brain language really are not neuroscientists. We really don't know much about the brain. And when we hold up these pictures of, all different colored brain scans, and we say, "Oh, look, this proves something," we don't know what we're talking about. You have to be a biophysicist to understand those brain scans.
Right. So it would be interesting to take brain scans of, say, a bunch of 14-year-olds, say 100, and then look at them in 10 years and see, what your prediction was. Not yours, but what somebody's prediction was, and how many of them became addicted to anything over that time, and whether the prediction had any value or not. Like, I doubt that if you looked at a bunch of brain scans, you could actually predict the future. But I'm not an expert on that.
I'm not an expert on it either, and I don't claim to know. Although I must say, I have taught in medical school. I have taught neuroscience. Or psychopharmacology, which is a particular aspect of neuroscience. But I don't claim to know anything about the brain. And you'll notice that I'm not using brain language as I talk. I'm not going to. Because I think that the problem of addiction is a fundamentally human problem. I think all we have to talk about is people. And we know people as people, not as brains. We don't see the inside of their head.
Right.
And so I have learned in my long life that the best way to talk about addiction is a human issue, in terms of what people are suffering from and what people are trying to do about it.
I'm getting some noise on your microphone. I don't know if it's rubbing against your clothes or something.
Oh, it was me. I was tapping on the side of my computer.
Okay. Yes.
You see? Now
you have
to be
careful when you got a microphone in your hands, because computers are so sensitive to picking things up.
Okay.
So what in modern life, what do you think? Like, we're seeing now, there's been certainly a lot of addictions in the United States and Canada, and a lot of it has been focused on the Black community, although I think a lot of that is to do with the, you know, preferential criminalization of Black people with drugs. But we're now seeing a lot of poor white post-industrial towns with huge addiction problems with fentanyl, oxycodone, or whatever. What are the factors in our society that are driving people to addictions?
Well, let me say two things. The first is that addiction is a much larger problem than drug addiction. Drug addiction is the addiction of the underclass, and that's why we focus on it, because, you know, that's them over there, right, in the ghetto or in the Rust Belt, and we can focus on them. But if we want to talk about addiction in general, we better talk about addiction, the addictions of the middle class and the addictions of the rich. I mean, the poor are not going to get addicted to horseback riding or to, you know, to buying 100 pairs of shoes or to gambling thousands of dollars. They don't have that kind of money. So, okay, so now let's talk about drug addiction with that caveat. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, yeah, and for years, of course, in Canada, the drug addiction of the poor Chinese immigrants was opium.
Right.
And in the States, the drug addiction of the poor Black ghetto dwellers was originally morphine, then heroin, then cocaine, then methamphetamine. And now the addiction of the tremendously expanding white underclass is picking up with methamphetamine, and then it goes into the prescription opioids. There's a whole story here. Why is there an expanding white underclass, and why is the white underclass the current sort of focus of attention in terms of drug addictions or the addiction of the poor? Well, I mean, there's a white underclass. We all, I think, know why there is. It's because we live in a absolutely bankrupt economic system, which we call neoliberalism, which is strangling the underclass, sending their jobs to other countries and reducing their wages to nothing and treating them like shit in their jobs. Well, that's why, because people are abused, and when you're abused and don't feel like you're worth anything, well, then you can find consolation and you can find some identity in being a drug addict.
But when I was a teenager, which was a long time ago, it was still possible in this town in Canada that I lived in that you could drop out of high school and you could get an industrial job. In the town I lived in, it was working in the grain elevators at the docks, at the paper mills, things like that. That was what was around. You could get a job. It was a union job. It had benefits. It had a pension. And you could raise a family. You could send your kids to school. And the vast majority of those jobs are gone now. And the same people, if you drop out of high school, you're going to be working at Walmart or McDonald's or something. Even if you graduated from high school, you might end up working at Walmart or McDonald's.
Yeah, and that shift in economics is devastating to a lot of people. I must say, I remember those days too, and I was part of that. But no, that wasn't great either. But it's worse now. Like, you know, those jobs. I had a factory job and made decent money, but oh no, I wouldn't want to spend a lifetime doing that. And I don't know how people could endure it. But anyway, it's way worse now. And suicide is taking off. So is addiction to all kinds of drugs, and so is the primary drug addiction, which of course is alcoholism, taking off. And so are all the other things that people can do to fill that void, to somehow compensate for being really not much.
Really feeling empty. I mean, people laugh about shopaholics, but I mean, do you see an addiction to consumerism as a real addiction, just like an addiction to fentanyl or alcohol?
Oh, of course. I must say, if there's any question about what constitutes addiction, the best book to read, and I highly recommend it, is the Oxford English Dictionary.
Okay, I got a copy of that.
Good. Look up a diction. Now, it needs to be the new edition. I doubt if you have a copy, but you have the abridged one, yeah.
I have the electronic version.
Yeah, right, okay. So look up definition 1A of addiction, and then you wouldn't ask that question, because, all addiction means is that a person is dedicated or devoted to something.
The state of being addicted or given to a habit or pursuit.
There it is.
Devotion.
You got it. You got it. Yeah. Now, of course, shopaholics fit that definition as well as money addicts and power addicts and gambling addicts and computer addicts and all the rest of them. Of course they do. And of course, in the extreme cases, which are seldom publicized, those kinds of non-drug addictions are terribly harmful. That is, people bankrupt their families.
Right.
And they wind up committing suicide, and they live lives of terrible shame and misery, everything that bad that can happen. And they go kill other people, especially in the case of love addiction. They go shoot their ex-girlfriend or their rival or whoever it is. So yes.
Could we say that the war on drugs is itself an addiction, because it creates money that a lot of people are dependent upon, and therefore, even though it's a failed behavior, you got to keep doing it because it keeps creating the money. Whether you're a bureaucrat in the government or you're a supplier of, drug war paraphernalia to the government, you've got to keep the war going, because otherwise, your stock price is going to drop, or your department in the bureaucracy is going to get closed down, and that's the end. And you're going to have to survive without your addiction to the money that it generates.
Yes, we could say that. That would make sense to say. But actually, I like your language better. I would rather say that the war on drugs is an infectious myth.
Okay, I'll agree with that. Yeah, and it's sort of like the war on everything, right? Like, we had the war on cancer that's been a tremendous failure. And we now have a war on immigration, although they don't quite call it that. I guess that would be a little too overt. But, basically we want to militarize the border. We want to have people kicking doors down to find, people that got from Guatemala to America to earn subminimum wage, which is better than where they were.
Yeah. What it is that, I love the concept of an infectious myth. Because most of us, and maybe all of us, are in love with simplifications that make life work. And so the war on drugs is a huge simplification. It just says, look, we got all these problems. Our kids are getting screwed up. Why is it? Well, it's because the drugs out there are misleading them and getting them into trouble, and we just got to find some way to get those drugs off the street, and everything will be hunky-dory like it used to be. Well, it won't. it's just a tremendous simplification. Likewise, in the old farming communities where, people from Latin America are coming up and taking the jobs in the meat packing plant and taking the welfare money, and people say, oh, we just got to get rid of those people from Latin America and everything will be hunky-dory. Well, it won't. That's why I love the concept of infectious myths, because they are infectious. They divert us from problems which are complex. And the problems are not impossibly complex. It's just that we can't solve them if we've given up our intelligence to infectious myths. We've got to think about them in down to earth ways, and that's what I think. I believe that's what you're trying to do. That's certainly what I'm trying to do.
I was just reading an article today on the Australian refugee crisis, and basically a bunch of people tried to come to Australia on boats from countries like Burma. And the Australians, because of their rigid adherence to no illegal immigrants, left them on these islands, and they're basically stuck because they can't go back home. The Australians won't accept them. And this reporter who managed to get to one of these islands to see the asylum seekers said this: many of the asylum seekers identified themselves as atheists, having given up their faith in God. Others have taken up drinking or trading cigarettes. They receive up to 3 packets per week. They trade them for local marijuana. Many take sleeping pills handed out by nurses, anything to pass the time and escape from their anguish.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that would be the story not only of those particular refugees, but of all people who really have no life. They've got no functioning life. Of course, they're attracted to any kind of a diversion that will get them out of there temporarily. Will, you know, take them to the moon for a few minutes or whatever it is. Of course they are, and any of us would be, and that again, to go back to the idea of poverty of the spirit. What if you have a whole world society, which is irrational in the way that situation is irrational in Australia for those immigrants? What if you have a whole world society in which there are these huge pockets of people who really are losing all their sense of meaning? Would you expect that to be an addicted world? Of course you would.
Yeah, I mean, I guess from those asylum seekers, if they think about how the system works, they understand that in a foreign capital, Canberra, there's people sitting around talking about their lives, and what those people decide controls the lives of the people on this island somewhere in Asia. And, you know, I think a lot of people in America might feel, well, there's people on Wall Street who are right now saying, you know, if we close down this factory, ship the jobs to Mexico, we're going to make more money. And the people in this little town that still have a factory, you know, really have no control over if that decision's made, when it's made. You know,
and just think about people at Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain. So, and somewhere people are in a room sitting around talking about whether they're gonna double or triple the pipeline, the Kinder Morgan pipeline, right, which runs over that mountain. And what all the implications of that, not only the local implications in terms of construction and possible ruptures of the pipeline, but the implications of Burnaby Mountain being part of the system, which is creating climate devastation for the planet. Think about that. I mean, it isn't just the forlorn, disadvantaged people who are in that position. It's the you know, the well off people, like the students and the professors on a mountain like that, you know, they don't feel good about it. And I think that the problem is, in fact, a global problem. Hence the title of my book, The Globalization of Addiction. I think it's global in the sense that it's not just class bound and it's not just regionally bound. It is in fact an era in history, an era in which the economic mechanism is out of control. It's out of anybody's control. And we all feel that, even if we're not, you know, even if we get a decent paycheck and we get a pension, still, you know, we're part of something which is really scary and ugly. And I think the people in the U.S. who have just elected this incredible person as president, how do they feel?
I think a lot of people felt with Donald Trump that they'd lost all control to the elites in Washington, and Donald Trump was able to play on that I'm going to bring you back control. And I think it's pretty obvious by looking at his selection of the cabinet that, you know, it's not happening, but it was a seductive message.
And
you know,
implications of that for alcoholism. Let's say you're on the edge of alcoholism, or you're on the edge of gambling addiction, and you see that what you took to be a potentially recoverable, rational world is going down the tubes really fast. Well, I say that makes it a little bit more likely for you to invest yourself in your in your addiction, in your alcoholism, in your gambling addiction, or your all the rest of the things, to lose yourself in that. And therefore, I see it as a really big problem, which extends way beyond the people, let's say the ghetto blacks and the marginalized white underclass.
I think the carrier factory issue, where Mike Pence spent money on tax breaks for carriers so they could save a few jobs and claim that Trump was going to kick some butt with companies, was kind of illustrative of trying to maintain this illusion that we're actually going to give you control back, but it's not really happening.
I fear that's the case. I mean, I don't really understand the American political scene, but that certainly looks like it, doesn't it?
Yes. One thing in my quote from Australia is at the end, it said, many take sleeping pills handed out by nurses. And it seems to me that doctors, the medical system, is playing a double game, because they've been handing out opiates since the 1800s. Opiates are still a big part of the addiction puzzle. And yet they've also tried to take control of the whole addiction thing, saying, we can manage this. But if drugs have any influence on addiction, the people who handed out OxyContin like it was going out of style must have some responsibility for creating the addiction crisis.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's really complex there. I talk to doctors. In fact, doctors talk to me because especially years ago when there was no way for heroin addicted people to get onto any kind of maintenance program. Mm-hmm. Some doctors were providing for their own patients. Like, they weren't making money at it. They're just providing some maintenance doses for their own patients illegally.
Right.
And they would want to talk to me, and they want to say, look, I'm doing this, but don't, they're afraid that people are judging them, thinking that they're evil doctors because they do that. And they're not. They're doing that because they know that patient. They know that patient is not going to get by if they don't have a little bit of drug of their choice for the week. So they give it to him.
And so, I mean, there are people dealing with chronic pain. And I mean, another irony is that a lot of people say that marijuana is quite effective with chronic pain, but it doesn't appear to be addictive, or whatever that means. But it's more illegal. You could get a legal prescription for some of these opiates or pseudo opiates, but you can't in most places for marijuana, even if it's less. I got less side effects, less damage to you.
Well, thank goodness we, in Vancouver at least, we now have ample medical marijuana, and I think that's a very good thing. And I hope that other places are getting that too, because that problem needs to be solved. But think about it in terms of fentanyl. Now here, fentanyl is the scary drug of the day, right?
And was it originally a medical drug?
Oh, fentanyl is the most used most used opioid in the world today.
Right.
And I mean most used legally in medical practice. It's used in hospital situations. It's not a prescription opioid so much as it is a hospital opioid. So here's an example.
Right.
We have something called breakthrough pain, which is terrible for an adult. It means that when the adult they're heavily medicated with opium, with morphine, and somehow the pain exceeds the amount of opium they're getting. They start screaming, and the nurse comes and gives them a shot, and it's okay. That's breakthrough pain. Children have great breakthrough pain, which means you've got children just imagine this, a hospital, a children's hospital full of children, and a child wakes up screaming. This tears me up, honestly, because I think of my own grandchildren when I talk about
it. Mm-hmm.
Like, a child wakes up screaming because they haven't had enough morphine. Well, what do they get? They get a lollipop. And the lollipop, it tastes good. and they take it, and in 10 or 15 minutes, they stop screaming, and they go back to sleep, and the angels sing, and that's good stuff. Well, you know what's in that lollipop?
Fentanyl.
Fentanyl.
I was you kind of gave the joke away.
By hand, but that's the point. Fentanyl. Yes. In that lollipop. Now, that can't be done in the United States because you can't prescribe it to a child under 16. But in England, this is what's happening. Fentanyl, and in all of the world, fentanyl is an extremely useful drug. And do you know, maybe I've tipped my hand on this one too, but do you know why fentanyl is so widely used?
Because, no.
Because it's safe. Relative to other opioids, fentanyl is quite a safe drug. And the reason that it can be used in the lollipop is it's so strong that you just have to put a very tiny amount in the lollipop. The child can't taste it. All opioids taste bitter.
Right.
So you don't want to, you don't want to taste an opioid lollipop if it's made of heroin or morphine because it's too bitter.
But I mean, if you're not careful with the dose, I mean, what if you multiplied that dose by 10 because you're taking it illegally and you're just kind of figuring it out for yourself? Oh. I mean, what's going to happen?
Now, fentanyl is a drug which should never be on the street. Of course it shouldn't. It's a dangerous drug because, just for what you said, people don't know how to measure it. I've measured drugs as powerful as fentanyl in the laboratory, etinitazine. And it's really tricky. You've got to have really excellent instruments, and you've got to have a steady hand, and you've got to understand the theory to measure this stuff properly. So no, fentanyl should never be on the streets. Of course we should get it off the streets.
Well, besides, I mean, you might be normally dealing with fentanyl that's being diluted by the drug dealer to make more money, and now you're dealing with pure fentanyl, so you might measure it exactly the same way and still get a much bigger dose than you're used to.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Fentanyl should be off the street. But what should not happen is what's already happened, which is that the United States has ruled that next year the manufacture of fentanyl, by the way, fentanyl doesn't come from China. It's manufactured all over the world.
Right.
So the manufacture of, so you can buy it from China, but most fentanyl is manufactured perfectly legitimately in factories all over the world.
Right.
But next year, only 75% as much fentanyl will be manufactured in the United States, and a number of other opioids that the DEA has ruled that they're going to cut down the manufacture. And now, just to go back for 1 minute to my breakthrough pain example, which is, of course, the most dramatic example I could think of. How many children are going to wake up screaming and there's not going to be fentanyl there? Well, I don't want to be in that world.
Right. Okay. But let's. Okay. So this child presumably is being treated with chemotherapy, or has had some horrible accident, and that's why they're dealing with this chronic pain. So let's say, in some cases, that child may never leave the hospital because they might die of cancer or die of the chemotherapy treatment. But let's say that the child does get out of the hospital, and they've been treated with fentanyl on occasion because of this breakthrough pain. Are they now addicted to fentanyl when they leave the hospital?
No.
So why are there all these stories of, so-and-so worked in the factory, ended up with chronic pain, went to the doctor, got OxyContin, then they stopped manufacturing, and then now they're getting it illegally. They're going to 5 doctors to get prescriptions. They're buying it on the street. Like, where do those stories come from?
The stories are true. The stories are true.
Mm-hmm.
But what's left out of the stories is who are those people who are having that problem. It's not if you or I or most of us around here where I live go to the doctor and we're, really in pain and he gives us some kind of a prescription opioid, our chances of becoming addicted are essentially zero.
Mm-hmm.
If a person who is seriously screwed up in their life, or they're dysfunctional, they're dislocated, they're living in an agony of despair and depression, those people, need fentanyl in a different way than you or I or my neighbors here would need it. And so, here's my prediction. I haven't done this research yet. I'm talking about it with some friends, but I did it in the past with other drugs. If you actually go to the coroner's reports and find out who are those people who actually die of fentanyl, what you will find is that they're people with long histories of depression, anxiety, and other drug addictions. Most of them will, like the two famous cases in Canada reported in the Globe and Mail a couple of weeks ago, you know, both those people were methadone patients. They died when they took fentanyl. So, no, I'm not trying to underplay this fentanyl problem. Like, it's a real problem. Lots of people are dying, and we've got to do something about it. I don't mean to understate it.
Right.
But I don't want to misunderstand it. Fentanyl is a demon that can grab you by the neck and drag you into addiction. It can't do that.
Right. But I'm thinking that the coroner's report doesn't have other parts of this people's lives, like were they abused as a child, sexually abused, is there a history prior to drug addiction? I mean, did the drug addiction, like the sort of the horror story of modern life is that, you know, children experiment, Joe experiments with heroin in university just to try it out, and then he's hooked. Like, is that the story, that he was perfectly normal until that point, or is there a history prior to drug addiction of some kind of abuse, of isolation, of like I said with Mark, with the book Addiction is Not a Disease, hopelessness and loneliness? I mean, are those at the root of the initial drug addiction?
Yes, and I can say that because my research has been primarily by just interviewing lots and lots and lots of people. And when you find people who are seriously addicted, there's always a history of misery, or what I call poverty of the spirit, or depression or anxiety, and it often includes child abuse, but not necessarily. But it there's always that kind of a history. People who are doing relatively well are not vulnerable. And we can prove that, because most of the people who take fentanyl or OxyContin or any prescription opioid have no problem. They walk away from it. Do you know about the self-administration machine in hospitals? It enables you to. It's a bedside button,
right,
and you press it and you get an injection. You get as much as you want. Of course, the machine is limited. If you go crazy, it'll cut you off.
Right, right.
But people go on those machines for long periods, and then they leave the hospital and they forget it. There's virtually no likelihood of them becoming addicted. Now, they're pre-screened. So if the people who are allowed to go on those machines are not people with a history of addiction, and they're not people who are miserably mentally distressed. But if you screen those people out, You've got a really good drug. So that's why, to go back to your question, you know, are the doctors playing a double game? Well, yes and no. Some are, and there is. I think the pharmaceutical companies are very definitely playing a double game, but doctors, most, I suspect, are very well intentioned people who don't want to overuse the stuff, but they don't want to underuse it either. So I think we have to be really careful not to demonize the medical field. Just like we have to be very careful not to demonize the drug, or not to demonize anything. By the way, there aren't any demons. We might as well forget demonizing anything.
Is it true in Canada that Native people have a much higher rate of addictions?
Oh yeah.
And I mean, if you look at hopelessness, if you think about a lot of Indian reserves and natives in the city, many of the reserves have no economic base because it's been destroyed by industrialization, by oil exploration or mining or things like that, by the residential schools. So there's a huge level of hopelessness on the reserves, and when people leave the reserves and end up homeless on the street in the inner cities, I mean, that's maybe even worse.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's really easy to understand. I think the native situation in Canada is one of the most instructive situations and one of the most discouraging and sad, because we know a lot about these native people before they were colonized in Western Canada. Mm-hmm. Because the colonization of Western Canada happened relatively late. Well, the anthropologists got there before the colonizers. And so we know a lot about these people. And we know that although they had, you know, they had numerous problems, like they had slavery and they had intertribal warfare, and of course sometimes the chief was a rotten guy and had to be eliminated. They had all these tragedies. They were not noble savages, but they did not have hardly any addiction.
Did they have drugs? I mean, there were mushrooms and things.
Yeah, of course they had here on West Coast lots of mushrooms.
Right.
But more than that though, they often had alcohol, because now in the American South they made their own alcohol, so they had it for centuries. But in Canada, often the traders reached them first. So they'd set up a trading post, say in Fort Ware, British Columbia, they'd set up a trading post. And they trade alcohol for furs, and that worked fine. And the Indians would come in and they'd bring the furs and they'd trade them for alcohol and they'd get good and drunk, and then they'd go back and work another year and bring in more furs, and it wasn't a big problem. They didn't have an alcoholism problem until the colonizers decided, well, we're going to take their land and build a big hydro dam here or put them on a reserve, then you get the chronic alcoholism and chronic addiction to every other drug. So
yeah, I think the big scam with the natives was, you were going to give you this reserve, but you have the right to hunt and fish on all this crown land. But what they didn't tell them is that we're going to cut the crown land up. We're going to log it. We're going to mine it. We're going to do oil exploration, and then all of the animals are gone, and the fish are gone.
Pipelines through it in the 21st century.
Pipelines, yes. And now I think one of the things that Donald Trump wants to do is he wants to privatize government land in the United States, and that's going to further put pressure on whatever native hunting practices and fishing practices are left. If he's successful in privatizing that land, they're going to be pushed off what little access to the land they have left.
Yeah, that's right. That's happening in British Columbia. I've seen it so far primarily with hydro dams.
Right.
Like we had what was once the largest hydroelectric project in the world, and that was in Bennett Dam in British Columbia. And I've actually worked with the natives there, and so has my wife. We've worked with the natives there who have gone through that process of having their land literally be flooded. They went underwater. And what's left is a bunch of drunken people.
Because they have nothing left.
They're
basically, well, you can't hunt and fish anymore, so we'll put you on welfare.
Yeah.
Which is the poverty of the spirit. And it's easy to blame the people who are sitting there on welfare, but you can understand, on a reserve with no economic base, you can understand why the people are hopeless. It's not their fault.
Exactly. So I think I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that native people in Canada are really, really good example. They're better than Rat Park or an animal example, because their culture has been destroyed, and of course the consequence is mass addiction, because culture really is at the center of the human spirit, right? We're cultural animals, and when our culture is destroyed, then we become something less than fully spiritual, happy, creative, progressive people, and sure, we become
right. In both Canada and the United States, Native people were put in in schools, taken away from their families, put in schools to turn them into, quote, white people, and the same in Australia too, and probably other ex-British colonies, and also in Canada, the ceremony known as the potlatch was banned, and so their sort of spiritual life, you talk about poverty, the spirit, their spiritual life was destroyed. They lost their language, culture, they lost pretty much everything, and it was our society that did it.
Yeah, it was our society that, it was the English guys who, and the French guys who did it. And then we discovered why those people were all drunk. It was because they had the gene for alcoholism. Well, and now
right.
I'm being out.
The gene. Right, like the gene for diabetes, that they never had diabetes before the white people came, but now they have a gene for diabetes, even though...
Well, exactly. And I'm glad you got the irony there. It's just crazy.
Genes are definitely an infectious myth. Bruce, I've had a really good discussion with you, but we're running out of time. So is there anything uplifting you can say in the last couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye?
Yes, I would say that these are troubled times, terribly troubled times, and in troubled times, I think you have to look for hope in the human spirit, and I do a lot of interviewing of people, and I think there's an awful lot of people who understand the nature of these troubled times with respect to addiction and all the other problems. And I think there's an awful lot of people who are working very hard to save this civilization from complete collapse. And I think they might succeed. And so I'm actually hopeful.
Well, thank you. That's a positive note to end on. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've really enjoyed this wide-ranging discussion.
It has been wide-ranging. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Goodbye, Bruce.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 125 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter @InfectiousMyth. Until next week, goodbye.